Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Bowlology Report. My name's Damien Fleming and we've got a cracker coming up. We've got that bubbly Aussie opening batsman, Marcus Harris, and keeping with our footballers who like their cricket, particularly when they were growing up, theme from last week with Tyson Goldsack, we've got former Richmond, former Giants footballer and former Victorian under 17 cricketer, I'll say he's a superstar under 17 age, Brett Deledio, but of course, our co-host and Mount Bibley Secondary College's greatest, Peter Hanscom. Pete, how are you?
I'm great, Flem. Thanks for that amazing introduction. Again, always good.
What was happening cricket-wise at Mount Waverley Secondary College?
Mate, we would play one round robin a year in the zonings. If you managed to win that, I think they were like 9 over games. You play a little round robin. If you win that, you move on to your districts, and then if you win that, you go on to states. So we were competitive-ish, but we didn't have a lot of depth, Flem.
That's not a million miles. I'm a lot older than you, but we were around that 9-10 over mark. I think we might have had 3 games, which you had to win, then you got going. But, the school system, particularly the public school system, is really providing some pretty good cricketers or cricketers' opportunities. 9 over cricket, you might be the originator.
Yeah, or maybe it's the way forward. People are just liking shortened versions of everything. So yeah, we got 2020 cricket. Let's make it 9 over cricket. Let's get the five over cricket going, and then we'll get about 10 games of 1 over cricket in.
Geez, it'd be good to call. You'd be up for it, wouldn't you?
Geez,
you wouldn't want me back.
You'd be swinging hard.
Hey Pete, let's get straight into it this week, and of course your little segment in what you need to know in cricket this week. Far away, Pete.
Yeah, I guess the big news in cricket this week, Flem, was the England-Pakistan test, or at least it was for me. Hell of a test.
Very good test.
Yeah. Ebbs and flows. That's what we like about the long format of the game. You never know what's going to happen. That's why you need the 4 to 5 days to play a test match. It was awesome to watch. That first innings, Shaun Masood opening the batting, 156. Thanks for coming. Like, it's hard coming in for the first test, first innings when you haven't seen the conditions. And he's come in, batted beautifully. I'm sorry?
I think it's 300s in a row for him.
Yeah, in 3 tests. Yeah, the third Pakistan opener to do that ever. So pretty impressive stuff. And what
do
I like...
Do you want to name the other two?
Got no idea, mate.
I'll have a guess. I'll go Syed Anwar and Mohsin Khan. No idea.
Beauty. Well, maybe someone listening to this can tell us after they've done a bit of research. But he had a lovely, lovely temperament of thought. But this might be the secret. He uses the Keeley bats, which is actually an English brand cricket bat. Just a lot of county cricketers use them. So I thought maybe, he's gone over there, got into the English conditions, really embraced it, and gone with a local cricket bat.
Well, maybe instead of using jute balls in the second half of the Shield year, every batsman should use a Keeley or an English-type willow, prepare themselves.
just get ready for it. Yeah, it just must be something different, something in the wood, Flem.
No, I like it. Very good.
Yeah. And our man, we mentioned last week, Bubba Azam, looking great. Again, that first innings, 69. He just looked in control. I love his straight lines when he's batting. Him and Coley look similar, and just classy. Like, you know, when you think like textbook cricket, they're just beautiful to watch. And I think exciting things watching him over the next two tests. I'm hoping that he can continue to pile on the runs.
Hey, and Pete, you know what hurt him? The end of the day. He needed to keep batting, didn't he?
Yeah, that
must annoy you, you know, yourself even. You know, just that starting when you're on a pretty good score.
Yeah, it can go one of two ways. It's you either have to start again and you're like, oh, you know, bloody hell, here we go, try and get my own again. Or you walk out there going, beauty, I'm already on 60. If I get out first ball, I've still got 60 and I haven't got a duck. So happy days. Yeah.
I'd take the 60.
I'd take the 60, mate. I'd take anything in test cricket at the moment, Flynn. And again, looking at the bowlers, Yasir Shah doing the damage for Pakistan in that first innings. He's just classy. He looks like he takes wickets all around the globe, which is awesome to watch, and it's what you want from your spinner. He's impressive and just getting better with age, Flynn.
Yeah, and I thought they had quite a good balanced attack, Pakistan. You know, when I heard it was a bit dry early, I went, oh, I tell you what, if they can get first innings runs, because, you know, Afridi left arm pace swing, I think he's going to take hundreds of wickets. Abbas in English conditions, even though it was dry, he's new ball bowling. And Jaheim, the quick. Probably the only thing they lacked, I mean, generally they've got a top order batsman who bowls quite handy off spin, like a Shoaib Malik or Muhammad Hafiz. Yep. And Shadab Khan didn't really get going for him. But I still thought it was a pretty good attack in that conditions.
Great attack and a lovely mixture between experience and just youthful out-and-out exuberance, which I love because it means the youngsters are learning the experience there as well. But you know, sometimes when you're a little bit older, you like the young boys to give you that energy to keep you going and push you through that third session, that last hour of the day where the legs start to get a little bit heavy.
And what about England? You know, the first thing's knocked over. How do you rate Ollie Pope? He looks a good player for me.
Really, really liking Ollie Pope. He sets up beautifully. He's owning his game, which is what I like to see. And he looks positive out there. He looks to go out there and try and score. So if you're bowling a bad ball to Ollie Pope, he's hitting it for four or he's getting up the other end. And that's putting pressure back on the bowlers, which is great to see this. Great to see it from him. And I think, you know, potentially a couple of the other English batters could maybe take something from that and maybe try and be that little bit more positive, which is what, funnily enough, we saw in the second innings. and it worked out.
I must admit, I was barracking for Pakistan on that last day. They had him in trouble, didn't they? But some good performances, as you said, though.
Yeah. We're going into that second innings. Which is a shame, just that Pakistan just didn't quite get going with the bat. A couple of starts, but nothing to really write home about. And unfortunately, out for 169 with a lead of 270-odd. Which you think, you know, a fourth innings chase, Flemmer, that's tough. Anything over 200.
That's a big one.
Yeah, starts to get twitchy. You have to bat some time. Again, there's going to be ebbs and flows in the fourth innings generally, especially if you're going to win it. And that's kind of exactly how it played out. I mean, England started relatively well with the bat, but then, you know, they lost four for 30, and you're thinking, here we go, Pakistan.
Game over.
Thanks for coming. They still need I still need 160 runs, 150 runs to get the game with two batters and some bowlers to come. But yeah, two guys, you know, that probably, you know, for their standards, they've been struggling a little bit lately. What I've loved is that they've been backed in again and backed in and backed in, and it's been rewarded with Butler and Wokes, 75 and 84 not out respectively. Yeah, they single-handedly won that chase, I reckon. That was awesome. 140 run stand. And you need, they had a bit of luck. A couple of balls falling short of some fielders and a couple of pop-ups that just didn't quite get there. But to win games of cricket, you need a little bit of luck as well. And I thought they were very, very impressive. And they would do some runs, and they delivered when it was needed.
Yeah, I mean, good summary, really. I mean, once you're chasing over 250, you need something special. And they got something special, didn't they? You know, Butler, you know, played his own natural game. I really like Chris Wokes as a player, but, you know, particularly in England, you know, his bowling's first class, and probably he hadn't got runs for a fair while, but you know what I liked about he was really assertive straight away. You know, if it's there to hit, he put it away. He's quite a correct tail ender, isn't he? I mean, he's not a tail ender in county cricket, averaging mid-30s. And Pakistan lost their way a bit, though. You said there was a few opportunities, but tactically they were getting it wrong, I reckon. You know, their short ball setup wasn't really there, you know, forcing them back, then going full. It just it seemed a bit disjointed. And, I didn't think Shadab Khan bowled very well either. You know, maybe it was a bit more of the same, but, I mean, he's a lot taller, bowls more wrong-ins than Yasir Shah. He didn't really land him. And an off-spinner would have been really handy, I reckon.
Yeah, even just a tie-up and end as well. Potentially an off-spinner can just, you know, maybe go at two and over, and you set a relatively defensive field with a couple of men catching around the bat in case something, you know, does pop up. But, yeah, they sort of seemed as if they were caught between plans. Didn't quite commit to bounce a plan, didn't quite commit to just top of off stump plan. And I think that allowed England to get away with some boundaries. And in England, they've got incredibly fast outfield. So even if you have got a sweeper out, either on the leg side or offside, if you hit it well enough, you can beat the man out there and still get the four.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, when it's over. And as someone said, they didn't send in a night watchman. They sent in a chase watchman.
This was
Dewey Broad got himself up the left, up the order.
No, this is my favourite part of this entire game. Broad's turning himself into a genuine all rounder almost, and I'm absolutely loving it. But great play and great initiative from Root as well. Like wicket falls, the new ball is maybe, I think it was two overs away ish. Sends out Broad, left-hand batter instead of a right-hand batter, with the ball spinning back in, and basically, I mean, must have just told him, like, go for it, mate. Just sweep the house down against the spinners and just try and do something against the quicks. And he comes out, like, they needed 21 runs. He comes out, gets, seven off four balls before getting out about five balls later. But that just took the pressure off Wokes. It meant he didn't have to spoil a run. He sits on his bat a little bit, and then he can finish the job when they need 10 runs or so to get. And I thought, oh, that was great. I'm all for that.
No, he's had nothing to lose. But for blokes that have missed out on Test cricket, the first Test, Wokes and Broad have had a pretty good summer so far with two to go. But hopefully that's the standard. Hopefully Pakistan don't drop off like the West Indies, and that they can keep competing. Because I thought it was that would have been a real cross against England cricket team, because that's their fourth test for the summer. So they're cricket fit. Not all of them have played every test. But Pakistan to come in cold like that and compete hard and, you know, virtually win it, I thought was outstanding. So, and it's not many times the ICC match referee, you know, grounds a player or similar, but Chris Broad fined his son 15% of his match fee for language. So I think Stuart tweeted, no Christmas presents for Dad this time, but that's got to be a first.
Wonder if Chris has just pocketed the fine and said, thanks for coming. That can be the Christmas present. But I think the big one coming up for those next two tests as well, Stokes to miss the next two tests. Ooh. It's going to be big. And obviously there's something going on there with Stokes and his family, and hope everything's okay. I think that's going to be a big loss there to England. And he's been batting four. So, you know, what do they do with the order?
And he just got a couple of wickets when they desperately needed those in the second innings. So, you know, a 3-1 cricket, but, they've got a hub, they've got the group of players. Obviously, they're not going to be able to replace a like for like, are they?
No. So it's whether they go the extra batter or the extra bowler. And, yeah, I guess, you know, with the tail doing a bit of wagging now, maybe they go the extra bowler and see how they go. But the test starts tomorrow, so I guess we'll find out and we'll be able to report about it next week.
I think they'll use a batter because Butler batted six anyway, didn't he? You know, they played the five bowlers. So, But, yeah, can't wait for that one, Pete.
Yep. And moving on, we're staying in England anyway. Just a little bit of county cricket news. And this game excited me. Kent versus Sussex. Flem, if you saw Sussex bat first, make a very reasonable total of 332 all out. And then Kent come out, make one for 530. And the only reason they stopped at 530 was because there was a compulsory declaration after 120 overs. They could have gone on, made another bloody 400 runs, but there was still enough time. And so that's credited to a young 19-year-old in Cox, 238 not out. Not a bad highest score in first class cricket at the age of 19.
Yeah,
and that's a pretty impressive way to do it. I don't think when we get a higher score, you have to buy beers. So he would have bought his slab. And I don't reckon, you know, he'll be buying a slab there for a little while unless he keeps going. That's the way to do it. Go big first. And then Leaning as well, who'd made the move from Yorkshire, who was middle order batsman for them, doing some good things, but he's made the move, got the opportunity at three and made 220 not out. That's great to see. Especially when, you decide to take that chance at another team. And it's worked out for him. He's got that opportunity. So that's awesome. And he's a good bloke as well. I like Jack.
Oh, yeah. Unfortunately for Jordan Cox, though, he won't be able to back it up because he's out for breaking the social distancing protocols. A young fans asked for a photo. Boom, out.
Oh, Stiff just trying to do the right thing, give back to the community, give back to the fans. He's gone. Oh, wow. Well, I mean, I guess you got to know these things in this climate, but geez, that's stiff.
That is stiff, but I think he'll get back in.
Yeah, I think he'll probably get another chance. But the one that stood out for me, and now we've got two double hundreds, but this still takes the cake for me. It's Darren Stevens is still running in, bowling medium pace at 44 years old. Now I'm 29, and I did a little bit of training today, and my back is that sore. And I didn't even bowl. So for him to come in at 44 years old and take 5 for 50 on day three of 15 overs, bloody impressive, Flem. And it's awesome to see.
It's just starting, isn't it? Like he took up bowling mid-30s, seriously. And I looked up, he's got more first-class wickets than me. He's got about 550. But
he could keep going until he's 50. This is crazy.
But what a win. I've never heard of winning by an innings and only losing one wicket yourself.
and on the third day as well. It just kept the game moving forward, and that's what I like. It's entertaining cricket, runs being scored, wickets being taken. How good.
No, I just like in isolation, cricket still brings up things that you think you'd never see, and certainly ticks that box.
Yeah, sure did, Flynn, and that's what I've got for Newsweek.
Okay, so that was Pete's What You Need to Know in Cricket This Week. Hey, Pete, first guest. I tell you what, this time last year, he was preparing to get himself back into the Ashes series for the third test, facing Archer and Broad and co. He's a teammate of yours in Victoria. He's a great man. He's a great personality. Well, and, of course, Marcus Harris. Harry, I know you faced Archer and Broad, but I don't think anything's prepared you for the Bowlology Report podcast.
No, I think this might be a bit harder than Edge Baston in the rain. Edge Baston, Headingley.
Oh, jeez. Oh, yeah. When there's clouds at Headingley, mate. That's tough.
And you win the toss and bat.
Look up, not down there.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting? Like, you talk to the sports scientists, they say humid, cloudy conditions have nothing to do with the ball, but Headingley is one place, isn't it? That if it's sunny, it is flat and runs fill, and then when the cloud comes over, the quicks are back in the game, aren't they?
Well, it was funny last year. Like you said, that was the first test I played, and we won the toss because the wicket was actually really dry, but it was sort of like, you know, that crappy rain you get in England, like that mizzle sort of stuff, and it was really dark. And somehow we got through that first day, and we ended up getting like 160, and then the next day, the way it always is in England, England are batting and the sun comes out, but we bowled them out for 60, so I don't know what to make of that, but it's just the way that it went.
I reckon it's like you talk about the conditions there. I reckon Headingley and Lords are the two places, speaking to the county players as well, where you basically disregard the wicket almost. And if it's a good day, you just bat. And if it's a bit cloudy, all right, well, we'll take it on. Everywhere else seems to be a bit of whatever. But yeah, those two places, it's incredible how much it changes.
Yeah, it's not fun playing over there all the time.
We'll get into that, Harry. Just firstly, though, in lockdown, watch the test, the Prime Amazon doco. What were your thoughts when they were? Did you get a heads up on what it was going to be, or did it just evolve? And secondly, you know, who were the star performers? Like, as soon as the cameras were on, who wanted to get themselves in there?
When I first got picked in the squad, was they just started making it. So I didn't know. I'd never been in and around the Australian team before, so I wasn't sure if it was anything too indifferent. So it just sort of took it in my stride a little bit. And what Petey can attest to it, Doc, the guy that filmed it all, it was just like another bloke that was there. And he was really good. After a little while, you just forget that he was there and you just went about your business. But I think from watching it, you can sort of tell, like, you can, like, when we're in England, Mitch Marsh, every time the camera's around, he'd be doing something stupid. And I don't know if you've ever looked at Peter Siddle's Instagram, but he always knows when there's a camera around. He's got professional shots everywhere. So he was pretty clever. But I think one man that never looks nothing comes bad of him in any sort of media is the coach. And I think he's got that pretty under control. And I'd fair say he knows when the camera's on and off. So. But he's good at that. But a lot of the boys, like I said, by the end, like, Doc was just another one of the support staff. There's 100 of them, but he was one of them. So you just forget that he's there.
Yeah, he was great. Doc, or Andre Mulga, however you say his last name.
Yeah, I don't know how to say his last name.
Doc's easy.
Doc.
But you'd be mid-conversation somewhere in the dressing room and you think it's relatively private, and then you look over your shoulder and there's the Doc sitting in the corner just filming everything that you're saying.
What the sneaky bugger was doing was like, he would set up stationary, like, little GoPros in the change rooms as well. So he obviously didn't have to be there he'd catch a few dummy spits and all sorts of stuff. You know, like, I remember, I think Finchie had got out in Adelaide in my first test, and he'd, I think it was caught short leg off Ashwin, and he came up to me and he goes, what do you reckon? I was like, oh, I said, couldn't really tell from my end, but if you didn't feel anything, review it. And he was like, oh, like just didn't really, like he'd only played a few tests. So he didn't review it. And then you watch the documentary and JL's coming down the stairs at a million miles an hour and Doc's following him. And then you got the stationary camera in the change rooms and Finchie walking in going, oh, what's going on? Then JL's coming in, they meet in the middle. I was like, oh, what did Harry say? I was like, oh, I don't know, mate. But it was terrifying.
That was one moment because I know there's some players. If the coach went to some players in my era, there would have been a full-blown fight. Now, I know Alfie's a black belt in origami or something like that, but I thought Finchie held it pretty well because he's disappointed he got out too.
Yeah, I think at that stage with the test side, we'd sort of just come out the back of all the stuff in South Africa and we're all pretty new to the side besides a couple of the older bowlers. Even Finchie, he's obviously the one-day captain, but he'd only played, I think that might have been his third test. So when the bloke's the coach and he's played 100 tests, probably haven't got a leg to stand on to try and punch his lights out.
And mate, what about back to the Ashes series? How hard was it early, you know, missing out and watching, you know, you'd have to say pretty good debut summer, wasn't it, against India and probably the only thing is you didn't go on to get a big score, but pretty tough, you know, running out the drinks early on.
Yeah, it was an interesting, like the back end of the summer, we had those two tests against Sri Lanka and I didn't happen to get runs in Monaco and everyone else got runs. So I sort of left myself open a little bit to leave my spot up for grabs a bit. But then once we finally got over to England with the Aussie A stuff, I started really well over there with that. So I was pretty confident going into the Australia versus Australia A game down in Southampton. And then we played, it was a pretty tough wicket. Petey had to play that game and it wasn't great. So no one really got any runs, but then Bangers, to his great credit, batted the way that he did, got 90 when no one else got any runs. So I think that was at the front of minds for people with picking sides. So you're disappointed not the side and you obviously want to be playing, but, you know, it is what it is and you understand that it's the five test sort of series. So you just think, well, do everything right in the nets, everything in the tour games we're going to get to play, make sure I do that right. So it was disappointing not to start, but I knew that with it being a five test series that I was hoping that my opportunity would come just to make sure I worked hard and did the right things and batted well in the tour games, which I did. So it was disappointing not to start, but I was always like hopeful of getting an opportunity throughout the series.
So when you're talking about you're going away, you're working in the nets and the tour games, was there anything you were trying to do differently or work on in that stage, or was it basically like just go back to what you know, trust your process and know that that'll put you in good stead for, you know, if and when you get picked?
Well, when I got over there, the main prep was back here in Melbourne, like in the indoor centre on the hard wicket. So, like, you try and replicate as much as you can, but it's obviously not the same. But then we got over to England and we had the tour game against Sussex and you play a couple of those. I got 100 in the first game, but I think, like both you guys know, in those tour games, they can roll out some interesting sides. So, but we had a good hit out against the England Lions. So I was confident. I hadn't played in England other than league cricket. So I knew it was going to be different to what I'd experienced before. So I was just trying to get used to the wickets, trying to find a method that worked. And I felt like that was working up until I got my opportunity to finally get a game.
And you've gone, well, I mean, you said it there, you've basically gone from league cricket to test cricket in the space of a couple of games in English conditions, and then up against Broad, Archer, guys that actually, like, they dominate left-handers or they feel like they get a good result against left-handers. And you look at Broad stats, it's amazing the difference between his left-handers and right-handers dismissals. What are you thinking, mate, going into that third test? Like, you've seen what they've been doing. How are you preparing yourself mentally to try and get in this battle?
Well, I was just happy to be playing. Like, I was at that stage, I was really confident. I'd come off the back of a good summer and I was really chomping at the bit to get in the side. So I wasn't I'd seen that he'd troubled Davey a fair bit, and, you know, Davey come off the back of a really good World Cup. So I knew it was going to be a challenge, and Even after the first innings at Headingley, got out to pretty good ball from Jofra. So it's just one of those ones that note me, go, alrighty, I've nicked off, doesn't matter, you know, get on with it with the next dig. And then then I got out to Leach in the second dig, I think, for about 20. But after the first test I played, I had a good plan to Broad with trying to sort of bat off on and off stump, on and around, and then sort of try and get outside the line a little bit just with the way that I'd set up against him in that test. But then, you know, it's like the cheeky bugger, his buddy taking 500 test wickets for a reason, but he's sort of bowling these wobble seams at you that are nipping away, and then he nips one back in, and then, you know, you get out twice on a umpire's call, LBW, so you're like, well, fuck me, but sorry about the swearing, Flynn.
No problems.
But that was the challenge. It was sort of, I worked on a few things, I know, and then going to the last test, Smitty threw me balls for about 45 minutes just trying to ask him, you know, any tips I can do. He goes, just don't miss the ball on your pads. So I said, oh, that's easy for you. But so it was just hard. Like, the way that I've been taught to play and I've grown up to play in sort of the Australian way is to stand there and hit the ball back down the ground. And in England, that's not always that easy. So that's what was trying to work things out on the go a little bit was – I'm trying to get myself outside the line of the off stump to Stuart Broad, who's been troubling all the left-handers, but then he's nipping it back at my pads and I'm getting caught in line because I'm trying to cover my stump so much, not getting nicked off. So that was one of the great challenges. And I think it's one of those things, it'll just be next time I go back over, whether it's county cricket, club cricket, international cricket, I think you're better for the run and, you know, hopefully got a better game plan.
And I reckon the tough thing is, Harry, is you went to Smithy, but you probably couldn't go to Dave. Because just about every innings, Dave was trying something different. And the ball that I found incredible from Broad, wide from the crease, and to be able to, it wasn't swinging, it was seaming. So both of you were trying to cover your stumps and you still had that ability to seam it away. It was incredible.
Yeah, I remember speaking to Davey, just asking what he was trying to do, and he was saying the same sort of thing. Obviously, he averages nearly 50 in test cricket, so he didn't have too much to worry about. That's what I said. And I said, mate, you'll be fine. You go home and make a million runs, but I'm trying to keep my spot on the side. But it was sort of, I don't know how to say it, not good, but it's sort of, you go, well, I'm not the only bloke that's battling out here in these conditions. So you sort of, and I remember saying that to Trevor Holmes after the series. I said, you know, it was tough conditions to open to. I think the only bloke in the whole series that actually did all right, the opening batsman, was Rory Burns. So I'm not sure you're going to try and replicate how he bats, but just the way he applied himself. But the way he applied himself and went about it in those conditions, I think probably could have taken a bit more from that at the time, looking back at it. But, yeah, like you said, I think as a batsman, I know, well, especially as an opening batsman, and we learned from playing with a Duke ball in Australia, it's quite easy. It's easier to set up for swing than what it is to set up for seam. So you know which way the bloke's going to try and swing it, but if you don't know which way the bloke's trying to seam it, how are you supposed to know? So if he doesn't know, so that was the challenge. And like I said, going forward, I think you even watched like the other day in the Pakistan and the West Indian series, it's been the same story. Blokes have struggled early on. So it's just one of those things. And I think as well, one of the things that did go under the radar was a little bit that they used the juke board they'd used in county cricket, I think it was the season before or something like that, with a bigger seam on it, which I would do if I was them as well. So that was another challenge that we had to face.
Yeah, it's funny that, Flynn, we kind of mentioned that last podcast, but with the cooker ball, how sometimes there's just a good batch of balls and they swing more or seam more. And if you're the home team, you're just going to find that batch like a fine wine. It's a good year of making balls. So get that batch and you know, help your home team advantage.
And to both of you boys, in hindsight, using the Duke ball for the second half of the year, it didn't seem to have any effect on our batting in that series. You know, Smithy's a bit of a freak. Marnus had been playing county cricket and getting runs. We are going back to, they're going to have to deal with the Kookaburra out here and we're going to have to deal with the Duke over there.
Well, my opinion is that the way that the Duke performed over here is so different to the way it is over in England that it wasn't really comparable. Like, they were, It kept the games interesting here, but they were also juicing the wickets up. So it was sort of, if it was a kookaburra ball, it'd be seaming all over the place. So it didn't really make too much of a difference. But I think like the best preparation you see is like a guy like Marnie going to play 10 county games before he even plays a tour game for Australia. And that was the best preparation of anyone. And then the guys that had been playing in the World Cup did well. So I think that's probably the best preparation. I know it was a good, I found the cricket was interesting with the juke ball in Australia, but I think it'll be interesting to see. I think it went a bit far the other way. I sort of agree with the things that Stephen O'Keefe's spoken about with sort of phasing out the spinners. It was really tough, you know, to play on grounds towards the end of a season and have a, you know, like a Johnny Holland spinner team out to win a bowie to victory or anything like that. Didn't happen that much anymore. So it'd be interesting to see how it goes this summer now that we're going back to the Kookaburra.
Hopefully some flatter wickets, H.
Hopefully. I think the Junction's been doing too much.
Oh, the Junction. By the way.
Yeah. Hey, just on Marnus, at what stage did the team start to pick up that he was trying to morph into Stephen Smith? Was it as soon as he made the test team or, you know, when?
Well, he's just like, I've never seen anyone like that loves something so much and is so passionate. Like literally, he's just enoughy, like a massive, just enough. Like doesn't, like he won't even, like there's blokes that love it, but then there's blokes who will go and have a beer and like switch off and, you know, talk crap with your mates. But Marnie's literally cricket 24/7. And I think when he started, he actually struggled the Shield season just before he went to England. And then he went to England and sort of, the floodgates opened a little bit. And I remember he batted really well in Southampton on that tough wicket. He got a really good 40. I think he got 40 out of something, but he batted really well and he was sort of walking in front of his stumps a bit more and moving around a bit and doing a few different things. So, but to be fair, no one really knew that or had seen how much he improved until he went out and batted in that test match in Lords when he copped that one in the gob first ball and then proceeded to get a really good, I think it was 50 to sort of save the game with Heddy. But, yeah, to his credit, he did really well, but he was him and I think Smithy equally loves him just as much. So I think it goes a bit both ways. I don't think it's just Marnie.
Well, Smudge has finally got someone else who loves cricket just as much as he does.
It was unbelievable.
Hey, Harry, we're talking about, I mean, you probably didn't even really get into that phase of, you know, fear of failure in England. Like you had six innings and you're always trying to work something else. But I also read an article saying, you know, the fear of getting hit in that Perth test match against the Indians. I mean, that attack that they had for that summer was quite amazing. Can you compare their attack at home on conducive wickets compared to England's in their conditions?
I think that the fear of getting hit one was that game in Perth when we literally all wore one.
It was the second innings mainly, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it was more the fact that I actually remember the first innings, me and Finch had got through to lunch and we never played at the ground before, but the wicket looked really green and then it was like 40 degrees. We went out after lunch and there was huge cracks that opened up in the, like day one after 2 hours. So I was going, oh, this is going to be a bit interesting in the second dig. And then I think in the first innings, Bumrah bowled a ball, the second he bowled a Payne, like a Yorker that went over the stumps. And then in the second dig, Finchie got his hand blown off. I got hit in the head. Uzi got hit about 10 times. He batted really well.
He batted really well, so yeah.
It was more a fear of you're not sure what the wicket's going to do. And it's like the old school whacker in a way with the cracks and stuff. And I think in England, there was no real fear. I think the wickets there are generally pretty even. They're not as quick as the Australian wickets. But then again, at Lords when Joffa really cranked it up and, you know, it was like a bull at a gate to Smith. You see Smithy get hit, you go, oh. I'd never worn those stem guards before, but before that first test in the nets, I'd whacked them on pretty quickly. So, I haven't seen too much bowling like that. But I think to India's credit, they're a bit, not unsuspecting because we sort of know what they are, but they're very accurate. And Bumrah can bowl out and out quick and he's got a very different action. At least with Joffa, you can sort of see the ball a little bit of a relatable action a little bit, whereas Bumrah, you haven't got anything. You don't go, well, I'll face someone like that in Shield cricket or I'll face someone like that in club cricket. You haven't faced anyone like that. So that's what was difficult. I think the thing with Jofra was that his arms, his actions seems to be always the same pace, so it can be hard to pick up if he's going to bang one in or if he's going to try and blow your feet off or anything. So that's what was tough. So I'd like to see Jofra come out here for a summer. I don't think he went quite as well in New Zealand on their wickets, but to be fair, some of those wickets weren't very good that they were bowling on. But yeah, it'd be a good contest between both of those.
He's also, Jofra's also just increased the amount of cricket he's playing as well. So, you know, when he in that Ashes series, he was relatively fresh, but since then there's been a lot of cricket being played with him. And as a fast bowler, I mean, Phil, I'm sure you attest to this, that the workloads on your body can start to get ridiculous. And to try and keep bowl 150K, I'm sure it's quite bloody hard.
Yeah, his test of his greatness will be longevity. You know, he's got two teammates who've taken over 500 test wickets, which is amazing. But they're just going to be careful how they use him. I think Stokes' body is important for that. You know, if Stokes can bowl between 10, 15 overs and innings out here in Australia, Archer and / Wood are going to be able to come on for short spells and bowl quick, which could have a real impact.
I think as well, what was funny in that Ashes series was obviously Jofra had come off the back of a huge World Cup and, you know, there's a lot of hype around him. And then he didn't play the first test and Jimmy got injured. So I remember we spoke about in the team meeting about, you know, he's going to come out, you know, really hard, but let's get him into his second and third spells. And I think in his fourth spell was when he's bowling about 97. So, and JL's going, he can't keep bowling this quick. He can't keep bowling like this. And he just kept coming back and bowling quicker and quicker and quicker.
Don't you love that? That's what you miss about not being around the team, is that sort of stuff. And we had Bucky Rogers on a couple of episodes ago, and he gave the baggy green to Pete. Who gave you your baggy green, and do you remember much of the speech?
Yeah, it was a good story. So I knew a couple of days before that I was going to get my that I was going to debut, and then I went for lunch with Sid the day before, and I said to Sidzy, I said it'd be great if Mike Hussey could give me my hat, because he gave me my WA hat. So I said that'd be like a nice little, you know, a double. So lo and behold, Sids tells JL straight away. So Huss was there to present me my hat, and he just sort of said, you know, I remember playing with you at WA, and you're a young little smart ass hanging shit on me about my clothes and what I was wearing and stuff like that. He just said, I hope you don't change. He said, everything you've done since you've moved to Victoria has been really good. So just keep doing what you're doing and be yourself and, you know, have fun pretty much. Like, he's a legend, Huss. Like, he's the nicest bloke in the world. So he spoke really well. But it was good to be able to get it from him, just with that he gave me my WA hat, then I got my Australian hat from him.
Yeah, I love Mr. Cricket, but does it devalue it a little bit that he seems to hand out every second one?
Well, I think because he commentates all over the world. A million. I feel like mine means a bit, though, because I know him. Some of those blokes don't even know him.
But yeah, I love the link. You're not going to have that many occasions where the person that gives you your state cap's going to be in that, you know, position, Aussie one. That's tremendous.
Yeah, that was good. So yeah, he's a good man, Huss. I've always stayed in contact with him the whole time. Fortunately, I played a few games with him at WA. It wasn't many. I think one of the last times I played with him, he did his hammy. I think it was close to around a World Cup. I might have been in India and he was coming back. And then I think the last time I would have played with him was when he was under the pump just before the Ashes up in Brisbane, and he got 100 at the G or something like that. So he used to give me a couple of bats here and there. His bats were shocking, but he used to give them to me anyway, and I thought it was the greatest thing ever. But, so he's always been someone I got along with really well.
Something special about a bat that's got, you know, MH just on the handle, you know, especially made for him. Even if it is a piece of shit, there's still, you know, something magical about it. It gets you going.
I think, Nathan, it used to be funny because when we were from Perth, Flem, like, used to have to tee up in advance with Nathan Pillon at the time at Kookaburra to say, Pillow, we're coming in. Can we, you know, grab some stuff? Because we don't normally have to ring in advance and He would send it over to you to Perth. So going to the factory was a big thing. And I think I've cotton onto it after a little while was that if you hadn't played much or you were with someone that hadn't played too much or they were just a rookie, he would do the old trick of like grab a crap bat and put someone's like Brad Haddon's initials on the handle and whack it in the top of the box and then give it out. He goes, oh, this is one of Brad Haddon's bats. And we go, oh, yeah, this is the best bat ever. And he'd get him every time with it. it was funny.
My worst scenario, well, the best bat I ever had was, Matty Hayden reject. Yeah. I mean, his worst bat was mine best by mile. But my first contract was Kookaburra at 18. 3 years later, I'm still in the Victorian team. They haven't said anything. I don't want to say anything. So I mentioned to David Emerson, our cricket manager, hey, I haven't got a bat. And Swan Richards, do you know Swanee from Grey Nichols and great character of Australian cricket. He'd started this mob called Eastern and their first signing was Big Merv Hughes. So he used to use half a tree, basically Merv, you know what I mean, just to smash sixes. So I was wanting to look around. Next night of training, Swan turns up with Eastern gear and a bat. So I batted for about three quarters of the year. You know, I'm batting 8 to 11. That's just couldn't get off the square. And eventually I rang him up, go, Swan, mate, can I get another bat, this one? He goes, mate, that's just a signature bat. I just gave you that as a one to have a look at.
He stitched you up.
Thanks, Swan. Yeah. That's not Mr. Cricket's bat.
No, but I think Pillow might have done it to Huss with how bad Huss's bats were. He's stitching himself up.
At least with Mr. Cricket, you'd know how much they weighed.
Oh, mate. Scales, ridiculous. Everything. You know who's like that? Sean Marsh.
I was going to say, is that where Soss got it from?
Really? Yeah, and Soss is not, he's easily influenced Soss. I'm not going to say he's not the sharpest tool in the shed, but you can go, Jesus, is heavy Soss. Literally after he's just put it on the scales.
Oh, no. Goes,
I can't use that.
he's got some bat scales that he carries around in his bag wherever he goes. And like you said, it could just be straight off the scale, the exact same weight as something else. Like, bit toe heavy. You probably shouldn't have this. I'll take it off you. And he's like, it is a bit heavy.
He's as strong as an ox and he uses these bats that weigh like 2A.
Hey, Harry, thanks for joining us here. Have you got another one, Pete?
I was just going to say, mate, just a quick one on just what are you doing to get back into the test side? What's the plan moving forward?
Well, hopefully play some cricket. I think it's going to be an interesting summer. Obviously, there's a lot of rumours going around about when we might play or when we might not or whatever. But I think until we get told we're not doing something, I think it's season as is. But I think it's just doing what I need to do, concentrating on playing for Victoria and making runs. And I think like we've seen in the past, if we're winning games for Victoria, it tends to be blokes get picked in the test side with that, just from that. So it's pretty simple. I think you can be, when you're out of the side, you can get too worried, too caught up in what other guys are doing. So just sort of concentrate on myself. And I think the good thing sometimes about, not a good thing, but can be a bit refreshing when you're not in the side, is you can just sort of go away and play state cricket and play for the Big Bash and just sort of, roll along a little bit with not having that burden around you of, going in and out of the test side. Rather, you can just, get on with your business. And then I think the good thing is that, similar to me, both of us, Petey, is that we've both had a taste of it. So then once you get back there, it's not a huge shock or, something really different for you. So, and I'm a realist. I know, like, it won't happen straight away. Like, it might take a little while. But if you come out and start the summer really well, I'm definitely prepared to get back in there. But if it doesn't happen straight away, then so be it. I'm content doing what I need to do for Victoria. But the goal is definitely to get back in the test side. But that doesn't eat me up at night.
Yeah, beautiful, mate. Well, I'm pumped to have you opening the batting for the Vics and just scoring a plethora of runs up there.
I'll get in first slip as well.
Is he in or not?
Nah, he's third.
Third.
Maybe.
Third. Maybe. I'm working my way up, Flem.
First one out of the court as well.
Yeah. Going on the podcast doesn't hurt. I reckon you'll be second slip for sure, Harry.
No, that's Pete.
Yeah, I'm second. Or the hammock, maybe.
Who's first?
Shorty.
Shorty's the first.
Okay. All right. Hey, Harry, thanks for joining us. Get back in the Aussie team and we'll organise a return baggy green from Mr. Cricket.
Yeah, sounds good. Thanks, boys.
Cheers, mate. Pete, what about our next guest? He was the number one draft pick in the AFL, 275 games for the Tigers and the Giants, all Australian, best and fairest. But it's about his cricket career that we're going to talk a fair bit today. For the fans of Victorian under 17 cricket teams over the years, he was a hard-hitting batsman, fast in-swinging bowler, probably bowled out swingers as well. Put your hands together for Brett Deledio.
Lids. It's exciting to have you, Lids.
Thanks, boys. Hard-hitting batsman. I did enjoy a good time out there, Flemmo and Pete, but never too many long times out there, which is probably much to my dad's disgust. He spent all that time watching me, and I'd often get out caught on the boundary, mate, to be honest.
So you're saying you're a 2020 player before your time?
I probably should have stuck at it, Pete, to be honest. Yeah, I just enjoyed seeing the ball sail through the air. seeing it go through on the ground through the covers wasn't as enjoyable as whacking it back over Long On's head.
Hey, Lynch, you grew up in the country. Now, your old man played one game for Carlton. Was he a cricketer as well? Is that who influenced you in the playing cricket as well?
Yeah, well, he started off, he was a tennis player as a kid. Right the way through to about 17 or 18. And then I think he picked up cricket later in his life, and he was playing out of just a small country town when I was 7 or 8, and I used to go and watch, and I'd fill in and field in the B grade or something back there. Never got the bowl or bat. I was filthy with that. But yeah, probably just watching Dad play early, and then we used to play in the backyard a heap, me and my brother. Yeah, it was something, as you know, as country boys, it's usually footy in the winter and summer all through the summer, the cricket all through the summer, I should say.
Didn't pick up the tennis racket at any stage either?
Nah, mate, I didn't have the patience for it. My back end was pus, so cricket was way more fun because if I wasn't batting, I could bowl and vice versa. So, yeah, tennis, mate, I was... Yeah, rubbish at that. And Dad still thinks he could beat me.
Beauty.
And, mate, what about your cricket and footy heroes growing up? Who were they?
Yeah, so footy, I was a Carlton man. Obviously, Dad played the one game there. So I was massive Cooter fan. Used to love just being able to try and hold the ball in one hand like Cooter could. But then later on, I was probably more like I love Vossie. And the way he played, because I think the Lions were so dominant in the 2000s, early 2000s. And then later on it was Juddy, mate. I wanted to be Juddy. Sleeve, number 3, loved it. So when I got to wear the number 3 at the Tigers, mate, I was destined to wear the long sleeves and the number 3. I thought that was it. But cricket-wise, I was probably always... I loved Mark Waugh and tried to emulate him, just clipping him off the pads. Loved punter. Could never really hook like punter could. You know, I was too scared of being hit. So no, wasn't that good at that. But tried to bowl leggies like Warnie and then and line and length like Pidge McGrath. So, mate, I'd anyone who was good at the time, I loved them.
That's some good heroes. Have you got... like a vivid memory of maybe growing up in the backyard or a ball you bowled maybe to your old man one day or something that just sticks that you can still see now?
I can, mate. And to this day, I've told Dad that I meant this, but he still doesn't believe me. I said, come on, Dad, come back. And he's having a glass swill on the Merlot. So he's got one hand holding the wine glass, the other hand he's trying to bat. And I've bowled this bit. I said, I'm going to try and hit this glass. He's been a smarter, so I'm going to see if I hit this. Big in-dipper, and it's come, bounced up, bang, glass smashed everywhere. Couldn't believe it. Dad was ropeable, and Mum's just like, well, serves you right. Thought you were better than the game, and he didn't have it knocked out of his hands. But, yeah, that's a vivid memory, mate. But most of the time I was playing with my brother and him just bowling for ages because I didn't want to get out. And then I'd eventually just pop him up a catch, then he'd bowl sorry, I'd bowl to him for two or three balls, nip him out, and then I'd get back in and bat again. So he was filthy, mate. He'd often just throw the bat and say, I've had enough.
Yeah, I used to do that with my older brother. He'd get me out all the time. He's about 8 years older. Just get me out. I'd kick the stumps over and walk in.
That'd be it. Crack it. Yeah, fair enough too.
And Lids, obviously your footy and cricket were going well, so much so cricket-wise, you got picked in the Vic under-17 team down in Adelaide. I was watching all those games because I was at the academy there. What were your memories and some of your famous teammates and potentially the biggest wicket you got in that tournament?
Oh, I don't know whether I got too many wickets. I was an opening bowler that we were playing on roads over there. Geez, they were nice to bat on. As a number nine batsman, they were nice. they weren't great to bowl on, Flem, but
Finchie was obviously... just before we get away that week, you knocked over a current Australian player, not in Test cricket, but one day player who will play Test cricket from South Australia.
From South Australia. Plays for South Australia now. Jeez, mate, I wouldn't even know. Tommy Cooper, is that who you're talking about?
No, because he, New South Wales, Alex Carey.
Oh, Alex Carey. Was he playing then?
Sorry, I saw a Carey. That'd be his older brother, wouldn't it?
Yeah, his older brother, Adam Carey.
Yeah, take that.
I nipped him out, mate. I remember that ball too. It was one of the better balls I bowled for the carnival. all these raps on him, and I was. This was the road that deck. Shawnee Dean made 202. I was next in. He just wouldn't go out. But Finchie was our captain. Obviously, he was destined for bigger things. We knew that all the way through. Who else was in our team? Mark Murphy, who now obviously Carlton ex skipper, superstar at Carlton. Stevie Gilmore, who was on the Vic's list there for a little while. Yeah, big hat. We were opening bowling partners. He was obviously a fair bit quicker than me. But and then we played obviously against Tommy Cooper, who was player of the carnival. Davey Warner was in that. Jackson Bird played for New South. Mate, but we were the best team in it, which was good. So we only had to play out a draw in the final to win it. So that was good fun.
I'm glad you brought up that last game there, Lids, because. I mean, you said Finch went on to bigger and better things, but in that game, he only got 34 and you second top scored with 85. So I'm feeling that, you know, had you chosen cricket, could have been captaining Australia now.
Well, it's funny you say that, Pete. After some terrible games, mate, I have often rued the fact that I never went to play cricket, fed up with footy at times. But, yeah, mate, that final was I remember Cam Matthews, who I actually went and he was at Hawthorn when I went down there. Big Kanga, he was our coach, and he said to me, mate, if you can give me an hour, because we just had to bat it out, so you give me an hour, I'll give you an hour. And I'm thinking, what's this going to mean, an hour on the piss, or am I... I didn't understand his call, but what he meant was he was going to let me just keep batting for an extra hour. And I was sort of like, well, that's not going to get me there. So I went with the, he's going to shout me for an hour, you know, as a young bloke. And, it was a really nice deck to bat on, and there was no pressure, really. I just went out there and had fun.
Well, I was there, Australian under-19 coach at that stage, so we're picking a squad, which you didn't get into, but I remember saying to Cam at some stage, going, you've got to get him up the order. We can't pick him as a number nine. But we picked Mark Murphy, who later went number one, Shannon Hearn, and a big quick call, Cleve Hughes, who you played with at Richmond too.
Yeah, Cleve, he used to love, he was probably, he gave a little bit more almost to his cricket in the sheds than he did to some of his training sessions, I reckon, the big fella. But he's a good-looking big rooster. I think he's a model now for Country Road. But, mate, I was a bit disappointed you couldn't get me in the All-Australian side. Were you a selector for that, were you? I've got a bone to pick with a few people about that.
Yeah, because you averaged about 60. A few more wickets might not help. But realistically, there's still kids that come through now. You know, Will Sutherland's with the Vicks now, Pete. But realistically, you know, cricket probably was never an option if you're going, you know, number one or top 10, would it? Like, because you're playing almost straight away, aren't you, football-wise?
Well, I was doing the math. Wait, to be honest, Flem, it came from like an under 15 trials. I made the footy trials, but I tried out for the 15 cricket and they left me out. So I was sort of like, oh, well, there you go, decision made. And then I just went with footy from then on in, kept playing cricket because I loved it. But yeah, that was where I thought sort of just chose my path. But there was no Big Bash, there was no IPL. Back then, there was like the money to be made was you're coming in on a rookie wage pretty much. And I think that was all the talk was about, was coming in to play potentially as a rookie. And yeah. I was thinking, well, there was 16 teams at the time when I started footy, and I'm starting on double what they're talking about for cricket, you know, with the chance of playing 11, you know, 11 players versus 18. So I just did the math, really.
Fair enough, mate. And it's you got to do that every now and then. But I was talking to Sean Graff earlier today. Big Graffy always has a few stories, and he mentioned that he got you down, even just to meet the squad, meet the boys during a Shield game. And one of the guys was actually really nice and got injured and even gave you a crack having a field. How'd you go there?
Oh, mate, that was against India, I remember. I couldn't believe it. Yeah, by the way, there's a thing called Diamonds in the Rough. So I think it was just all country boys come down to play, just doing like a week of training, extra cricket stuff. But yeah, me and a couple of other boys, they just said, we're going to wide up pretty much. I knew Matty Elliott, who was in the team at the time pretty well, obviously being a Kai boy. So he gave me a pair of strides and whatever else. And I've come out and I'm feeling it mid-off. Because I think Hodgie made a heap. And so they just said, you're not coming out the field, mate.
So I reckon Hodgie would have been fielding.
He might have made a duck, actually. He just came and said, I'm not fielding. But Verinder Sehwag, he's batting. And, mate, he has creamed this one. And I'm trying to, like, impress. I'm thinking there's no way I'm having any misfields. I'm going to be all over it. So I'm knee down. I'm down thinking I've got this one covered. Hits my knee before I've even got my hands down. It rolls away. They scamper through for one. And I'm just like, I
can't believe it. Oh, no.
I was filthy. But the Indian crowd, they, because one of my worst choices in hairstyles was long blonde hair, but I looked like Ian Harvey, who had similar hair. And the Indian supporters didn't like halves for some reason. So they're yelling out, Harvey's a wanker. And he wasn't even out there. So I'm just like, oh.
So that's probably why he went to AFL and not cricket then.
Didn't need the Indian supporters, mate. The Indian supporters didn't tend to like footy, so I was clear with that. But yeah, mate, when Sachin came out to bat, mate, you should have seen the crowd. They went wild, and it's still one of my claim to fame that I've actually got to shake the little master's hand, mate. I'm pumped with that.
Oh yeah,
that is gold, isn't it? What a great experience. You know, Billy Brownless actually was not a bad district player, you know, young, and he had a 12-man experience there. Amazing, and particularly India, so there would have been a crowd at least, you know, if it was one of the other nations. But, mate, so it's footy. You go as number one. Like, how early did you know you were going number one? And what about the expectations, you know, in that pre-season and your first season?
Well, in terms of knowing when I was, as a young bloke, I used to read all the press and you hear what people are talking about just because you're interested to see whether you're rated and how well you're going. My biggest thing was I wanted to keep playing good footy and I wanted to go as high as I could. That was just a goal of mine, regardless. You know, getting on a list was great, but I wanted to try and shore it up a little bit, you know, and see whether I could get pretty high. I found out the night before, Greg Miller, the recruiting manager at or footy manager he was then at the time, at the Tigers rang me and just said, look, mate, we're going to go with you at pick one. That just was like, calm down. I don't have to stress too much.
How long before the draft do you get told that?
The night before. So this was, I'm sitting there watching, I don't know what we're watching. We're just kicking back on a Friday night and then no one were coming down to the draft. So we knew that much, but we didn't know where we're going. But yeah, he rang and then I was good mates with Ruff, so I was on the phone to him and I just said, oh, this is, mate, they've told me I'm going one. They're touting you at going number four. We're going to get to play together. It's going to be awesome. How good's this? We get to the draft the next day and Hawthorn bugger it up and pick him at two. So all our thoughts and plans had gone out the window. But, yeah, in terms of pressure, Flem, when I first got there, I didn't feel pressure because I was number one. I just wanted to perform and earn respect to my teammates, I suppose, and just train really hard and show them that I wasn't just going to rest on talent alone to get a game. I wanted to try and train my way into a side and perform in the games that were leading up into it. And then once I got my first taste in the NAB Cup to then, or Wizard Cup, I think it was back then, to then play round one, I just wanted to keep playing as much as I could and just make sure I did enough week in, week out to keep playing. So I think I only averaged like 15 touches a game and kicked a goal a game. But, mate, I was wrapped, played all 22 in the end. And, yeah, mate, it feels like forever ago now that that was when it happened.
Hey, how significant was round two? Because when you played that second round, you'd played twice as many games as your dad.
Yeah.
Significant.
It was huge, mate. And I think I rang him and just said, look, mate, no more input, thanks. I've got you covered. No, it's funny that, mate, my first game, I played senior footy when I was 15, my first game, and I found a heap of space, mate. I got a heap of the footy and I was just like, this is awesome. This is what senior footy is all about. I started my first AFL game on fire, 5-6 touches in the first quarter. I'm just thinking, oh, I've got this clocked. No worries. I think I finished with 9. So, like, come on, jockeys the ball, lollies real quick, and just realise that you don't ever get ahead of yourself in AFL footy, that's for sure, because it kicks you in the backside pretty quick.
And were there, you get in, you go to the squad with the Tigers straight away, any characters from the other boys or some tough coaches that you kind of had to win over with your training?
I was always just petrified of like the fitness guys because I was never really gifted long distance stuff and they used to just flog you with stuff. So I'd try and butter them up a fair bit most of the way through and just be like really become good mates with them and just be like, oh mate, it's not really my strength, you know, like I'll be good.
You're at fast.
Yeah. You're fast. But in terms of like characters, mate, I tried to just get in with the old boys as quickly as I could because I felt that was the best way to learn and get as much experience. So I was, I remember ringing Dad, or Dad rang me. I wasn't ringing anyone because I was still on prepaid. So I had to worry about my credit. and I was just like, oh, I'm out to lunch with Nathan Brown and Matty Richardson, Kane Johnson, Wayne Campbell. And he's like, oh, geez, mate, that must be great. And I was just like, yeah, well, it is, Dad. I'm learning so much. This is awesome. But, yeah, mate, characters, oh, mate, there's plenty of blokes that were funny buggers, but, geez, it's a long time ago. That's 15 years ago. Kane Pettifer was probably one of the funniest.
Oh. Blokes.
A guy that I played at, he's from Kai, so I spent a lot of time with him back and forth from Kai and shooting trips and all sorts of things. But, yeah, him and Rory.
The boys seemed to love him.
Pets.
Oh. Yeah, and he took big hangers too, didn't he? He carried on afterwards.
Yeah. Mate, he, yeah, well, he nicknamed himself the P-Plane and Plough got a hold of that after a game we'd lost and he hadn't played very well and he goes, P-Plane, more like bloody P-Brain. And the boys just lost it. They thought that was hilarious.
And what about Richo? I mean, he's much loved, isn't he, these days, opposition teams. But, you know, he was such a magnetic force on the forward line. You know, an amazing athlete.
Oh, mate. He's still, and I tell everyone this, that he's the best player still that I've played with. And I've played with some genuine stars, and obviously Rancy and Dusty Martin, Jezza Cameron, Lockie Whitfield, those boys up north. But Richo's still the best player that I've played with. For his size and ability to run the way he did, and mate, he's the best contested mark player of all time and still kicked 800 goals, 820-odd goals. Mate, please. Yeah, but, mate, one of the most generous big blokes you'll ever come across. I remember he took me to a Metallica concert just out of the good of his heart when I was a younger bloke. Yeah, you'd love that, Flem.
Yeah.
But this is how big a dog he was, and this is how you know you're a big dog. Metallica are there in the, like they're about to come on. The mosh pit have turned around and they've started giving it to Richo. We're in row one. Richo, Richo. So I was just like, this is great. You are the biggest dog I've ever come across.
Oh, Mate, that's Matt. I remember seeing Plugger at a Def Leppard concert, you know, but he didn't get the chanting from the mosh pit. Well, there's no mosh pit at Def Leppard. You've got to be big.
Oh, mate, and that's they turn it like, oh, there's Richo, Richo. I was just like, oh, this is awesome.
It sounds like you had some cracking mates, but a couple of them may have just thrown you under the bus here a little bit with a potential golf trip down to Anglesey. That's just kind of want to delve into a little bit more there. Liz, do you remember going down?
First, who's showing you this?
Oh, no, you never reveal your sources here, mate. So this will keep my cards close to the chest.
Yeah. No, we this happened around 2014. I don't know whether you remember or we watched much footy, but we were rubbish most of the way through the year. We're okay, but we were around the mark. We won 9 games in a row, but on the back of those 9 games, we were doing a heap of like bonding. And we were
good
lucky
for the
enough.
Culture.
Yeah, culture. Exactly right. But yeah, we had 2 buys that year, and one of the buys was like round 18. We'd just beaten Port Adelaide, I think it was, and we had 3 or 4 days off. So I said to the boys, right, we're going down. My wife's family got a house down in Anglesey. We'll go and play golf down at 13th Beach. And then we'll, you know, have a feed at the pub and then we'll go back to their place and we'll just kick back. It'll be pretty tame, pretty quiet. Anyway, there was another group of boys that were staying in Barwon Heads. They've cottoned on. They've come and played golf with us. They've come back to the pub in Anglesey with us. We're, like, putting ridiculous drinks on made shots on the pool table to purchasing. Everyone put in 20 or 50 bucks or something. We bought, like, bottles of Captain Morgan and beers and whatever else. My father-in-law's pumped because he just had a fridge full of beers because we just went straight to spirits. Mate, I don't know whether you've had a night on the Captain Morgan, but I tell you what, the next day I was ready to check out. That was it. I looked at my phone. Nah, that's it. I'm not drinking again for the rest of the year. I was cooked, mate. We had a great time and we bonded and we continued to win. So, mate, a lot can be said for that.
Yeah, team bonding, mate. It's huge. Massive job.
And have you ever gone back to Captain Morgan?
Yeah, 100%.
There you go. Hey, mate, you had such a good run, didn't you? You played so many games and then the injuries just started to come one after another. Can you talk about, like, coping with that, firstly, from having an uninjured run and then also, you know, myself being an injury-prone fast bowler, some of the methods I went to use just to get myself on the park, you know, in the end, I was trying everything.
Yeah. Well, I guess when I was going through my run of just playing, I didn't know any different. I just thought, well, this is what I do. We weren't a great side. And so I thought, well, if I can get better and train harder, maybe that'll make me better, which will make us better. So I just flogged myself basically for 8 to 9 years of hardly took a break, really. Even when I had my time off at the end of the year, I'd see that as an opportunity to try and go again and see whether I could add something else. To the point where I'd go back. We'd finished playing. My brother was still playing finals for his home club, or for Kai, back for Kai, and I'd go back and train with them. Like, I'd just finished the footy season and go back and train. I was just like, oh, well, I may as well get an extra session in. Maybe that'll give me a leg up, you know. But, it wasn't until, like, 2014, I reckon. Yeah, 2014, I started to get I had my first, like, calf niggle, and I had Achilles problems for a little while, and I think a combination of, overload in terms of, like, because I flogged myself and never really took a proper break for so long, but also because I had Achilles problems, I'd try and really strengthen the Achilles, which then I think stressed out my calf and my soleus, and just whenever if I did it too much and could never just get a really consistent run. I'd always play, you know, 16 games in a row, but never be able to put together a whole season without getting a little niggle. And then by the time I'd left the Tigers in 2016, I think I'd missed when I left the Tigers, I think I'd only missed like 8 games maybe, but I only played 32 or possible 72, I think, at the Giants. So, mate, that you're right. In terms of things that you try, like I've tried PRP, which is obviously taking your blood out, spinning it, putting it back in to help it heal better. I've tried dry needling, just like not just leaving it in there as acupuncture, but like trying to stimulate, get blood flow in it. So, mate, that is one of the most painful things I've ever done. I've tried the shockwave stuff where you, like you're zapping it. Running, all that sort of stuff. Sled work, mate. I've done it, and I just haven't got an answer. To the point where, yeah, mate, I hate running, and I don't really want to ever run around and around in circles on a cricket or footy oval ever again.
And fair enough too, mate. But with that, like, you've gone from a career basically of no injuries to then in and out, on and off the field, never really, you know, hitting your stride probably or the way that you want to go about it. What did that do for you mentally when you're missing these games? And then did you try and was there someone you could go to or someone you used maybe at the club or outside the club that kind of helped you through?
Yeah, oh, mate, I had plenty of people close to me to be able to gain perspective on it all. The hardest thing was, mate, is because I've been so durable, so you just get used to being able just to push through. And that probably hurt me a little bit early on with my calf injuries because I just thought, I'll be right, I'll heal quick and I can get through this pain. But then as they kept mounting up, I just had so many times where I was just like, this is ridiculous. But Wayne Campbell was great for me. He's one of my close mates up at the Giants. One of the reasons I went up there, and he'd be the first bloke over to our place after I'd injured myself when I was sitting at home, knowing that I had another 3 or 4 weeks on the sideline, or in some cases I had 8 to 10 weeks because I'd hurt the tendon. So be a bottle of wine, plonk, and say, righto, mate. Yeah. Next little bit, not going to worry anything. What we need to do is just clear the mind.
Yeah.
But, mate, like, as I said, I had perspective about my injuries, and I wasn't too hell-bent on what was going on with my injuries because I had I had a shocking run, to be honest, mate. When I first went up there, I lost my pa the day I was moving up to Sydney. I lost my auntie to breast cancer in the first couple of months. Then my sister-in-law had her brain tumor come back, and then not long after that my little nephew was diagnosed with a non-related brain tumor as well, and then we lost both of those two guys as well. So like there was I had plenty of perspective, and we
perspective had
a terrible run, mate, and there was no need for me or any chance of me complaining about a calf injury when I had my brother-in-law who's just lost his son and his wife, and he's got to care for his other son by himself, and my cousins who have just lost their mum, and a lady who was basically my second mum when I first moved down, you know. So, mate, yeah, there was no time for poor me. It was just, right, let's be thankful for what I did have, and that was a job and a beautiful, healthy family, and, things to be grateful for, mate. That's all I kept focusing on, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's a good focus.
Brilliant. And, mate, another bittersweet moment was obviously when the Tigers went on to win the premiership. They knocked you out in the prelim. So tough just to bitter. Deal with yourself. But you must just bitter, you reckon. What about a bittersweet for some of your teammates?
Yeah, it's not, there's no doubt, Swim, that there is a little sweet bit, but it's not very big. I'll be honest, mate. I was heartbroken when that happened because I thought that I was a real chance to have that success when I was there, and that's what I wanted. That's what I was training for and flogging myself for to get that. But, mate, credit to them. They turned it around at the end of 16 and turned themselves into the powerhouse that they still are now, really.
Yeah.
So it's been enjoyable to watch, mate, because they are an enjoyable team to play with, but there's not too many there still now that I went through with when I first started, and even less that are playing there now.
Yep, and we've moved on. We don't want to talk about Tigers Premiership, mate. You're not there. I don't like the Tigers anyway, so. but, mate, a pretty big decision over the last year, I guess, was your retirement and then moving on into further roles. Firstly, how did you know it was time to retire?
Well, it was probably, mate, as most athletes will probably tell you, they want to keep going forever. And I was no different. I thought that I could still play and probably still think I can play now. But my body just, as much as it hurts me to say, just let me down too many times. And it was not worth the pain that it was putting me through, but also my wife and the kids and just the miserable mood that I was always in because of my injuries. And regardless of the chance of playing in, you know, four games here and missing another four or five and then another four, it just and this was a really frank conversation that I had with Cambo and Leon Cameron. And they just said, mate, look, just don't think it's worthwhile going through with it. And have you really thought about what that looks like in terms of your headspace? You've had a great career. Do you want to keep going with it? And I think basically they're just saying, mate, you're getting the ass. Sorry, you're out. Yeah.
Leeds, did you, Pete's still playing and we want to play. The hardest thing I felt, and luckily I had a job coaching, you know, where we're heading to, I was looking forward to that, but it was hard to, you know, when you retire, you're actually giving up and you train yourself not to give up. That was the hardest thing for me, was to give up. That last final call.
Yeah, and I still probably haven't given up enough. I still train too hard. It only took me 3 or 4 days post end of season celebrations and whatever else to go for a run. I just don't want to be that fat old bloke on the beach who used to play AFL that no one recognises anymore. So I keep training, mate. But you're right, it is hard. And you still have that itch to want to play. Mate, I've got aspirations to play with my brother down at Torquay at some stage, whether it's next year or if we actually get back on the park at all at the moment. Yeah. But, mate, it is. It's hard. And you don't want to ever give it up because you just love it.
And obviously we're all in tough times, and the position at Hawthorn as a playing coach would have been ideal, but you know that hasn't worked out for yourself and a lot of people in the footy industry. But you've gone into player management, so you've got the opportunity to create some dreams for players like you 15 years ago.
Yeah, mate, I went into coaching probably because I felt like that was what I was most qualified in, and I love the development side of it in terms of working with young blokes. And when that was taken away, obviously through whatever's happened, the next best thing was in terms of development and developing my passion was going into probably player agency. And I was lucky that my manager, who I've been with for 17 years now, was taking me on board and teaching me the ropes at the moment, which is, it's really exciting, mate. And as you said, it's really guiding young people through that are, young boys through that are in the same position I was, and I'm just giving them everything that I learned over the journey, and you know what I know that I liked in my management crew is what I'm trying to develop with them, and it's exciting, but it's in its infancy at the moment. You know, we're doing a lot of these things, mate. A lot of Zoom calls. I'm a pro at these, but it's got its challenges.
Okay, to finish up, been a fascinating chat. We did it with Goldie last week. Can you pick select your favourite cricket 11 of all time?
I can, yeah. It's not just Australian, so I've gone worldwide. Opening the batting, I have Big Haydos and Davey Warner, a couple of dashes, Grey Nick boys that just smash it, love it. As I said earlier, I loved punter. So
yeah,
punter with a goatee. I want a punter with a goatee and the baggy green, no helmet. And with the ridgeback. I used to love the ridgeback. At number four, I've gone for one of the best all rounders of all time in Jacques Cullis. I've probably emulated a little bit of my game off him. Being able to bowl and bat a bit, not quite as high.
You scored quicker than Jacques.
Yeah, he probably slowed down a bit, but
I feel like you hit the ball further as well.
What's that, mate?
You hit the ball further as well.
Didn't hit it very far. Well, I didn't watch him that close. Number five, one of the all times most stylish batsmen ever in Brian Lara. had the pleasure of meeting him in the back stalls of Boutique one night. <with the belief. laughs> Brian Lara, mate, one of the great stories. Yeah. This was a really tough one. I could have gone either way here, but I went with who I really like to watch, and that's Virat Kohli at number six. I thought it could have gone maybe higher up the order, but I like the other boys a bit more. My batting wicketkeeper, with a special mention to Pete Hanscom, Adam Gilchrist. Sorry, Pete.
No.
He was okay, Gil.
Just. Kumar Sangakkara probably just missed out there as well. He's another one that I love to watch. So stylish. I've gone for a big, dangerous left armer who used to like to bash it a bit too, which is Mitchy Johnson at number eight. Loved Warnie at number nine. Got to have a king of spinning there. Why is that funny?
Normally he gets picked for his off-field activities, but you forget that he was pretty good on the field as well.
Oh, mate, I didn't go for anyone for off-field here. I'm all on-field. I'm about performance. number 10, and I love this bloke, Wheels, swings at Dale Steyn. Angry, love his passion. One of my all-time favourites to watch.
Yeah.
Number 11, big Pidge McGrath, mate, just on a dime. I've even picked a 12th man. Steve Smith was the unlucky bugger who's 12th man, because I could have had him at six for Kohli, but I think he'd be really good at carrying drinks. And Flem, you're the coach, mate, so well done.
Oh, thanks, mate. Yeah.
Even after Flem's disappointing under-19 selection crisis, he still gets the coaching.
I didn't know that. So
I'm going to redo that, and you're number one. Pete, what'd you make of that team?
Well, it's definitely heavily performance-based. I think if you put that, we'll see, but we put that team up against Goldies, I think probably on-field you'll be doing a lot of damage, whereas Goldie's team maybe off-field might be doing a bit more damage. But no, one hell of a team there, and some really, really classy players.
And Lids, mate, thanks a lot for the chat. You sort of took us everywhere there. We had a bit of a laugh, and that, talking about, you know, perspective as well, what's happened to you, you know, later in your career. I think you're in a great position to be a fantastic player manager. So thanks for coming on the Bowlology Report. But most of all, good luck with the after footy life.
No worries, boys. Absolute pleasure anytime. Love to come back.
Thanks, Lids. Well, that's it for the Bowlology Report. How good, Marcus Harris and Brett Deledio were fantastic. Pete, also we can promote next week. We've got one of Australia's finest opening batsmen, probably the original two-pot screamer in the Aussie team in my days. It's the beauty. It's Michael Slater, Slatsy. I don't know if you recall him playing, but he didn't block too many.
I don't know. I was watching a one-day game the other day, and he might have been striking at 50. So it could be an interesting discussion next week, Flynn.
Actually, that is a question, because if you look up, I reckon his strike, I'm only guessing, I reckon his strike rate in Test match cricket would probably be quicker than one-day cricket. So we might ask him that to answer why that happened.
I reckon he might know his stats as well. So we'll test him out.
No doubt about that. Also, just a shout-out, thanks to all the listeners and people subscribing, making comments. Two listeners in Antigua, the CPL's starting up. They probably wanted to know what was happening there, but I don't know if you've been there. What a great little island. Like, only 30,000 people, and they've produced, like, Sir Vivian Richards, Sir Richie Richardson, Sir Curtly Ambrose, Sir Andy Robert, a lot of sirs. But some of the greatest cricketers of all time, and very passionate cricket fans as well.
Must be something in the water, or maybe the rum.
I think more the rum. It's delicious. But that's the Bowlology Report. Thanks, Pete.
Thanks, Flem.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.